Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, everybody? How's your day going? We have a fantastic show for you. A lot of really big news breaking today. And we have, needless to say, some updates from the Democratic debate, or I should say, the responses, the fallout to the Democratic debate. I mean, the right wing is just doing nothing but giving us material all day long. So I got a Bernie Sanders story coming up here in a second. Everybody go get your tinfoil hats because we might actually put them on today. You guys know I'm not a big fan of formal conspiracies, but I think there may have been a formal conspiracy involved in this debate fallout. Then we got President Obama announcing, making it official, that we're going to stay in Afghanistan longer. Unbelievable. There's a new Edward Snowden out there. These leaks are now about the drone program and what exactly is going on with that behind the scenes. And what do the internal memos say? Because remember, when there were investigative journalists who came out with some shocking figures, like over 90% of the strikes are not getting the intended targets, everybody in the government scoffed, and they said, that's not right. Are you kidding me? You can't trust them, investigative journalists. Well, you should have trusted them. But now we know internally what they're saying and just how effective these strikes are. And Fox and Friends is going to yuck it up, laughing at the Democrats. Donald Trump releases a Bernie Sanders, an anti-Bernie Sanders campaign ad. Just absurd. And man, Rand Paul, boy, are you going to feel bad for Rand Paul. I felt bad for Rand Paul. I mean, this dude, his campaign has become the biggest joke in human history. I can't wait to discuss that. All right, so let's get started here. And we'll kick it off with, I got to give you what's been on my mind all night, like last night when I saw some information on this. It's been on my mind. I got to get this out of the way on the top here. All right. The establishment response to the Democratic debate has been nothing short of pathetic. So Bernie Sanders won according to literally every single immediate poll. And without fail, press outlets had headlines that declared Hillary Clinton the winner. Now, we discussed that yesterday, and in the midst of that conversation, I tried to make clear that what we're talking about here is not an overt conspiracy, but more of a systemic problem with the establishment media. And the way it works is there's this thing called the Overton window, which is basically the spectrum of thought that's allowed in the mainstream. And you always have the establishment media networks hiring people that fall within the spectrum of acceptable opinion. So it just so happens that everybody who's hired by these different companies, they already have a bias towards people like Hillary, and they just read into the debates whatever the hell they want to see, and they all said Hillary won, even though the people said Bernie Sanders won. So yesterday, we didn't put on our tinfoil hats. I was just describing the implicit biases that are present in the mainstream media. Well, today, we might have to reach for those tinfoil hats. Now, you guys know I'm not a formal conspiracy guy. I don't know if there's a single formal conspiracy that I believe in outside of the ones that are just proven that we know of now. I mean, it used to be considered a conspiracy that the U.S. overthrew the Iranian government in 1953, And then the CIA declassified those documents recently, and we found out, of course, we were involved in that. And there's other things, the Tuskegee experiments, Operation Northwoods. Those are things that used to be considered, oh, conspiracy, but now we know that it's just true. Those things happened. So what I mean by I'm usually not on board with formal conspiracies is that I don't think there's this secret cabal of elites in a small group that meet together every few weeks or every year or something like that, and they plan the way everything's going to work. No, again, the system is much more based on implicit biases than just an overt, smoke-filled back room where they're calling the shots. Except in this case, where there might actually be a smoke-filled back room. So, three things have happened since the debate that I don't think you can explain without invoking some kind of an overt conspiracy. So first, the poll on CNN.com that was up directly after the debate, it had Bernie absolutely crushing Hillary. He had like over 80% of the vote. And there may have even been a few polls, because one showed it's Bernie with 75% winning, the other one was over 80%. It was either different polls or people just took a screenshot of it at different times and sent it to me. But here's the thing. They took it down. Now, they took it down, and then they were running the articles and had the massive headlines about how Hillary won. I mean, some places like Slate, Time, one of them had, or it may have even been CNN, Hillary's clean sweep, something like that. So still, we're not in tinfoil hat territory yet. But here's the second thing. They replaced the poll, which had Bernie winning by a landslide, with this. For everybody listening on the live show, this is some sort of political prediction calculator, and it's not a poll. It's just not a poll, but it misleadingly looks like a poll. So they replace an actual poll where Bernie Sanders is crushing it, and they replace it with this, which is not a poll, but it makes it look like it's a poll, and it shows Hillary Clinton winning. And then here's the third thing, and this is where I pound my gavel. According to Media Equalizer, CNN.com is actively deleting pro-Bernie Sanders comments. And many people are reporting this. I mean, here's one comment right here. A guy named Christopher Warburton says, quote, CNN keeps deleting my comment off of their site. Please copy and paste this and post it all over their debate coverage. Time Warner Inc. owns CNN. Time Warner Inc. is Hillary's seventh biggest financial supporter. CNN is posting all over that Hillary won the debate. CNN's own polls show that 81% of the viewers think Bernie won. CNN will not even post the results of their own poll. If this isn't some Orwellian 1984 crap, I don't know what is. We need to show corporations that we're not taking the manipulation anymore. And then it says, hashtag Bernie2016, hashtag confront CNN, Dem debate, CNN, CNN is corrupt. So they deleted this repeatedly, and they've deleted other pro-Bernie Sanders comments repeatedly. No, we're at the point where there literally may have been a phone call from a top Hillary campaign person, top Hillary campaign advisor, who called some top guy at CNN and said, here's the deal. You're going to make it look like on your website Hillary won, and you're going to flood the internet with articles saying Hillary won, and we don't care what the reality is. We are going to override that and drive the narrative in the direction of Hillary Clinton. That's the point that we're at right now. Now, understand, I could be wrong, and it could just be the usual, which we talk about all the time, which is the implicit biases of the media and all their different issues, whether it's a bias towards the establishment, a bias towards neutrality, you know, bias towards false equivalence, as we often talk about between the Democrats and Republicans. This could just be one of your run-of-the-mill biases. But the way it's unfolding, it really does look like you have people in the mainstream media flat out in cahoots with the Clinton campaign. Just flat out in cahoots. So everybody should be aware of this, man. Everybody should be aware of this, because it's possible that this doesn't have that much of an effect, or it has a backlash effect and more people end up supporting Bernie as a result of it. But it's also possible that this drives the narrative in a way that the narrative was driven back when it was Al Gore versus George W. Bush. Al Gore won the debate, but the media had such low standards for George Bush that when he strung together a coherent sentence, they kept saying Bush won. and that affected public opinion of it. Palin versus Biden, where Palin was able to string together a sentence, and they said, up, she won because of that, even though Biden obviously crushed her, and then that drove the narrative. Now, obviously, in that case, it worked out that Obama and Biden won, but it was misleading when the media kept acting like Sarah Palin is a serious person when she's not a serious person. And bottom line is, they weren't giving facts. They weren't being honest. They were trying to say Palin did better than she did. But this case, it's much more than that here, because according to all of the instant polls, Bernie Sanders destroyed in that debate. All of the articles say Hillary destroyed, and then you're deleting Bernie comments and you're replacing polls with nonsense things, prediction things that show Hillary winning. It doesn't add up unless there's an overt bias in favor of Hillary Clinton. Guys, what we need to try to take away from this here is people who really care about anti-establishment candidates, whether it's somebody like Larry Lessig or it's somebody like Bernie Sanders, you got to double down. You got to move forward. You got to push hard. I mean, I every time I cover a positive story on Bernie Sanders, as I mentioned to you guys before, I worry that people will get the wrong impression and they won't donate to his campaign, they won't spread the word, they won't do the right thing because they'll get complacent and they'll go, well, he's doing all right, so leave it at that. No, look at what you're up against. You're up against the establishment and big money all over the place. I mean, Bernie Sanders is not taking money from big donors. Hillary Clinton is taking a tremendous amount of money from big donors. She's a giant sellout. Naturally, the elites in the system are going to want her to win, and they're going to push for it. They're not going to take this laying down. They're not going to take some populist democratic socialist getting into power laying down. So we got to be aggressive. We got to fight through this. Again, you guys know I'm really not a formal conspiracy guy in many instances, but this is really, really starting to look like one. All right, now, we got to go to President Obama and his announcement today. Well, actually, you know what? Let me go to Jeb Bush first. Because this is an interesting story on the Republican side. So we just spoke about the Democratic side a little bit. This is worthy of a long conversation here. Okay. So Jeb Bush has kind of been struggling in the polls from day one. He's got the Bush name attached to him, so that's a pretty big downside, or at least it should be a pretty big downside. Who knows if that's one of the main reasons why he's not doing well and why his campaign hasn't taken off. It might be a mix of that and his personality and everything else about him. But big money did pour into his campaign early on, and they know, the elite know that, hey, this guy is a Bush. He's from one of the dynasty families. He's going to help us out. He's going to be on our side. So they try to prop him up. They try to make him seem more popular than he is. They're trying to help him out. But he had some poor debate performances. Now, since he is an establishment candidate, I said at the beginning that you have to look out for these guys, because it happened with John McCain. It happened with Mitt Romney, where they didn't do well in the debates, and they were just trailing behind. And then eventually the Republicans went, oh, fine, I'll vote for him. They held their nose and they voted for him. So Jeb Bush is kind of in that camp as well. But we get some news today from Politico that it's really not looking good for Jeb. So one of the things he started doing recently is flying commercial. He used to fly private everywhere, and he used to stay in the most expensive hotels. Now he's flying commercial. He's staying in cheaper hotels. Sometimes he's driving long distances instead of taking flights. And his campaign's honest about it. They're like, yeah, the money situation is not too good now. So big money donors see this, and they're getting more afraid, and they're not sure they want to back him anymore. Now, he's still in the race. He's polling at, I think, 7% or 9% nationally, which it puts him in the top, whatever, 5 or so. So it's not like he's down and out completely. But when you're at the point where you're cutting back on, you know, the way you're doing your campaign, and that might not seem like a big deal to you or me, flying commercial or driving long distances or staying in cheaper hotels, but that is a sign. And we have seen stories recently, like I said, of there are some establishment people who are like, I can't really support Jeb anymore because I don't see any hope. I don't see him really bouncing back and leading or, you know, being aggressive with this. Look out. Jeb Bush might go down. Now, there's other implications to this as well, which is what makes this such an interesting story. Remember at the beginning I told you guys, Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio. Those are your three establishment fallback candidates. Now, you might see, whatever, Ted Cruz might make a Newt Gingrich-esque run and, you know, lead the polls for a little bit or win the Iowa caucus or something like that. Donald Trump has been dominating the entire time. But I told you guys, the establishment fallbacks are the ones you have to look out for. Well, Scott Walker dropped out, garnering roughly negative 12 people to support him. He wanted to save face, so he dropped out. So then Big Money was like, okay, now it's between Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, and they distributed between those two. Well, now Jeb Bush is on the ropes. Guys, if Jeb Bush goes out, it's just Marco Rubio left as the establishment fallback candidate. If that happens, we're almost certainly going to have a Donald Trump candidate in the general election. There's a good chance he wins the primary if the establishment fallbacks backing out. Because everybody else on stage, to one degree or another, they're somewhat serious, but they're not really all that serious. I mean, let's say, or they're not really all that electable. Even to get through a Republican primary, a guy like Mike Huckabee, he's not getting through. Guy like Rick Santorum, come on, don't laugh. George Pataki might not even exist in the real world. He might just be in our imagination because he's that irrelevant. Bobby fucking Jindal. Ben Carson, it's not happening. It's not fucking happening. So if Jeb goes down, and we don't know for sure that he's going to, it's just there are some signs now that he might. If Jeb goes down, and Marco is the only one left against Donald Trump, and Marco is basically a child, he's the definition of an empty suit. He just parrots talking points that are fed into his ear, and he doesn't know dick about anything policy-wise. Well, I mean, Donald Trump is going to run roughshod over Marco. Guys, this is getting really interesting. Now, the thing is, I mean, some people might take away from this, oh, good googly-moogly, batting down the hatches, let's go full bore against Trump. But in all seriousness, I don't think Trump is necessarily worse than the other guys on stage. I really, really don't. Now, obviously, he's more obnoxious in many ways, and he's arrogant, and he says some more over-the-top things every once in a while, and I don't agree with him on 85% of policy. But on the Republican side, at least he's one of the people who's talking about, I'm not going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He said at one time, I want universal health care back in the day. He recently said it again on 60 Minutes. He said he'll keep us out of Syria. He might be one of the more reasonable on that side. I mean, I would say, and I think you guys know this, that by and large, I think Rand Paul is better on the issues, but he's struggling tremendously as well, too. In fact, he might drop out very soon. So, relatively speaking, for that side, it's not the worst thing in the world. Now, again, I don't necessarily believe Trump even when he says the few things he says that are good. So it's still a giant question mark. But in terms of the pathetic Republican field, it wouldn't even necessarily be a bad thing if he's the one that gets through. And I do think that might make it easier for the Democrats in a general election. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know for sure. I'm not giving you guys a concrete prediction here. But it's getting fucking interesting, man. This race is getting totally interesting. And we're just going to have to wait and see how it unfolds from here. But if you're a Trump fan, you have a reason to smile today. Okay, now, God damn it, I don't want to get into the war story because I feel like I need more time than 6 minutes, which is what I have before the break. I'm going to skip ahead and do this other story because I could squeeze this one in 6 minutes. All right, Marco Rubio. Since I mentioned him before, now we'll do a story on this man-child. Marco Rubio is going to go on Fox News to attack the Democratic debate, and he's going to engage in some classic projection.
I think the biggest threat to her candidacy is her outdated ideas. If you watched that debate last night, it looked like something from the early 80s. It was basically a liberal versus liberal debate about who was going to give away the most free stuff. Free college education for people illegally in this country, free health care, free everything. Their answer to every problem in America is a government program and a tax increase. That's all been prescribed time and time again. And this is stuff from the 80s, the mid-80s. And we're back there, except that, as I said before the debate, it became exactly what I predicted it would be, a race to the left.
All right, so I love that clip because he says so many things that speak more to Republicans. So, for example, he says, well, I mean, the problem is what we're talking about here is outdated ideas. These guys represent outdated ideas. We're having a debate from the early 1980s here. That's what it is. Oh, really? It's the Democrats who are having an outdated debate. Your entire party is based on failed ideas. And that's not my opinion. That's empirically proven. So when it comes to economics, all of you guys believe in trickle-down economics or voodoo economics, as it's more appropriately called, which is this idea that if you cut taxes for the rich and deregulate, well, then everything's going to be great and there's going to be so many private sector jobs created. But we tried that in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And what happened? The Great Depression, the stock market crash and the Great Depression. Because when you deregulate and you cut taxes for the rich, what you have is a boom-bust cycle. So you have all this wealth creation, but it's not real wealth creation. And then eventually the bubble bursts, and we're left worse off than we were before. And then it's not just in the 19-teens and 1920s we learned this. We also learned it under Ronald Reagan. People like, oh, Ronald Reagan's economic record was fantastic. Except that it wasn't, because the second he fucking left office, all of his shitty policies caught up, and then we had a recession. Again, under George W. Bush, same thing. And Bill Clinton helped with this too, because Bill Clinton was a right-leaning guy on economics as well. I mean, he repealed Glass-Steagall. He signed the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which repealed Glass-Steagall, which was a necessary firewall between investment banking and commercial banking. That also led to a tremendous crash. So again, deregulating, cutting taxes for the rich, it increases income inequality, and it crashes the stock market. And every single fucking time you try it, you fail, and then you come out 5 years later and say, I know what the solution is, deregulate and cut taxes for the rich. So you guys are the ones who repeat the same ideas. And I like how he says their answer to everything is government, as if it's like a monolithic thing and as if it's like, you know, they're all the same because they think there are government solutions to something. Well, Marco, they think government is the solution in some cases, which is why they're running to be in government. If you don't think government is the solution, then get the fuck in the private sector. But who runs for a job and says, I don't believe in this thing I'm running for? Could you imagine that in any other field? I'm going to become a tennis pro, but I don't believe in tennis. Well, why the fuck are you becoming a tennis pro? That doesn't make any sense. This is what the entire Republican Party is based off of. You know, I don't believe in government, but I'm going to run to be in there anyway. Well, that's ridiculous. And government programs, like, if you try to attack a problem with a government program, there's only thousands of ways and thousands of different programs you can create to try to attack a single problem. And some of the programs work better than others, and some of them don't work at all. So there's variation in there, and it requires a smart person trying to craft the best solution. That's not monolithic. That's not all the same. You know what is all the same? You guys, because you guys say, no matter what, deregulate and cut taxes. That's your answer for everything. So you are the ones that repeat yourselves over and over. You're the ones that have stale ideas. And the entire time you talk about it like the Democrats have stale ideas. And let's be clear, it's not even true that the Democrats say government is the answer to everything. Hillary Clinton said it and Bernie Sanders said it during the debate that of course we all believe in small business. Of course we all believe in, Bernie said, medium-sized businesses as well. You know, we're an entrepreneurial nation. There's nothing wrong with that. So it's not correct, as I've often laid out on the show here, there are some things where government is the answer, some things where the private sector is the answer. That doesn't make me monolithic. That doesn't make me have stale ideas. That makes me nuanced. That makes me actually give a shit about the issues and have a balanced opinion. So, for example, do I want the government making video games? No. Do I want the government making couches? No. Do I want the government making movies? No. Cars? No. The private sector handles those things better. It's been proven. We see throughout history, cars from the Soviet Union were horrendous. They were beyond shitty. Cars out of the U.S. were much better. So yeah, some things, capitalism is the answer. Private sector is the answer. Government shouldn't be leading the charge there. But in other areas like healthcare, like education, that is empirically proven that government handles it better. Look at the other modern nations. So again, it's classic projection. It's Marco Rubio accusing the left of what he's guilty of. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to get into some serious stuff, President Obama and the Afghanistan war, and the new Edward Snowden and his leaks on drones. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. You guys, which song was picked for the break? Oh, that's hilarious. I'm not sure I've ever heard the original, which is what you just heard, to that. I heard, what was it, the South Park version? Was it Butters singing it? I don't know if I've ever heard the original. The comments on the video are fucking hilarious, by the way. a lot of people are like, you know, I think that guy might be gay. You think? All right, let's get to some serious stuff here. I mean, it feels wrong coming off of that break to getting into some super serious stuff, but it's exactly what we're going to do. So it's now official. President Obama, for the third or fourth time now, has announced that he's keeping troops in Afghanistan longer. And this time, it's no more foreplay. He's going to leave office with troops still there. So as of right now, there's 9,800 troops still there, and he's saying that he's going to leave in at least 5,500. So Huffington Post reports on this, quote, Obama had originally planned to pull out all but a small embassy-based U.S. military presence by the end of next year, a timeline coinciding with the final weeks of his presidency, but military leaders argued for months that the Afghans needed additional assistance and support from the U.S. to beat back a resurgent Taliban and hold on to gains made over the last 14 years of American bloodshed and billions of dollars in aid. Officials said Obama will outline plans to maintain the current force of 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through most of next year and then draw down to 5,500 troops in 2017. So, of course, recently the Taliban took over the city of Kunduz, and that led to reevaluation and the U.S. saying, well, maybe we should stay there. But apparently us bombing a hospital didn't make us re-evaluate and go, well, actually, maybe we should get out of there. So here's my favorite part of the article. Listen to this. Quote, upending the troop withdrawal decision, however, carries broad political implications. Obama campaigned for the White House on a pledge to end America's involvement in the two wars he inherited, Iraq and Afghanistan. Now he'll likely finish his presidency with troops back in both countries. So Iraq and Afghanistan will now go down in history as Obama's Vietnams. Let me ask a very basic question. What are we gaining from staying there? What is victory? What would constitute a situation where the U.S. would say, we're going to declare victory and get the fuck out? Can anybody who's in favor of the war define what victory is? I know what they originally said, even going back to the Bush administration. I know what they originally said is the reason we're going in there and what would equal victory back in 2001. You guys remember? I should say 02, 03. You remember what it was? They said, well, the problem is the Taliban is giving shelter to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. So all we need to do to get back for 9/11, so there's a reason for it, all we need to do is go in there, defeat al-Qaeda, and then we're out, and then we declare victory. The original argument wasn't we need to stay there, defeat al-Qaeda, and the Taliban, because the Taliban is a guerrilla army. Al-Qaeda is an international jihadist network that wants to take over the globe. Whether or not they could do that is a separate question, but that's their goal. Whereas the Taliban, it's more nationalistic and specific to the region. That's why they exist, and that's why they do what they do. Horrible people. They're Islamists through and through. They want to implement Sharia. They're a horrific group, but they don't have international ambitions. And they're not saying, hey, we're going to attack the U.S., and, oh, look, the U.S. discovered plans of them attacking in Seattle in November or some shit. No, that's not what they are. So we go in there. We knock out al-Qaeda. Now, somebody like me, I think we could have done it a different way. That would have been a rare time where I would have said, yeah, to get back for 9/11, you want to knock out al-Qaeda, go ahead, but let's do it smart. Let's either use special forces or go through the proper legal channels and use limited drone strikes to get al-Qaeda. I would have been fine with it there, but I would have been out very quickly within a year. These guys said, no, let's do an invasion. And then after we knocked out al-Qaeda, they go, hey, what are you guys doing? Why are you still there? Well, we defeated al-Qaeda, and now, I mean, the Taliban's still here. We don't really like these guys, the Taliban, even though they're not a direct military threat to the United States of America. So this isn't about self-defense anymore. But, okay, we're just going to stay here and fight these guys because fuck them. They're bad dudes. So you move the goalposts. That's exactly what you did, is you move the goalposts. Now, we're familiar with them moving the goalposts in other contexts, too. What do they do in Iraq? They said in Iraq, well, the problem is Saddam Hussein did 9/11. We learned that wasn't true. Then they just moved the goalposts. Well, he has weapons of mass destruction. That wasn't true either. And also the idea that he'd use them if he had them on us immediately, totally made up. And then they moved the goalposts again to he's just a bad guy. And there's a lot of fucking bad guys out there. You were his ally when he was doing his worst atrocities against the Kurds. People forget to mention that. We armed him and we were his buddy when he was doing his worst atrocities against the Kurds and against Iran. So if he's a bad guy, that's not a reason to go in there and do a war. I mean, there are bad guys in South Sudan. There are bad guys in the Congo. There's a bad guy in North Korea. There are bad guys who are our allies. The Saudi government is one of the worst governments in the world. But we don't use that as, oh, my God, they're beheading people for drug use and sorcery. Let's go topple the government and put in, you know, a puppet dictator. Why is that argument only specifically applied to areas where it just so happens you have some other geopolitical reason to be in there? No, guys, this is not about what they say it's about. This isn't about protecting us, and this certainly isn't about altruism and spreading democracy. If we wanted to spread democracy, we would actually have democratic regimes in the places where we invade. Usually we invade, and then we put a fucking authoritarian in there. So this is just absolute out-and-out imperialism. Even under a democratic president who's supposed to be anti-war, he's like, well, I mean, come on, we can have some troops there, and we can stay as long as we want, really. Why? Why? And ask the American people what they want to do. Guys, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying if we pull out of Afghanistan, well, everything's going to be hunky-dory and it'll be a utopia there and there'll be rainbows and everybody gets a puppy. That's not what I'm saying at all. Perhaps the region totally devolves into chaos. But what does that have to do with us any more than the chaos in South Sudan has to do with us or any more than the chaos in the Congo has to do with us? And usually, guys, history is more complicated than just one side's pure good, one side's pure evil, and, you know, we need to go in to prevent a genocide. Oftentimes, there are complex factors that go into wars, and both sides are shitty people, and both sides have some good people. And in Afghanistan, for example, we just covered the story about how our fucking allies were raping children, and our military would let them get away with it because they're our allies. This isn't about morality, this isn't about civil liberties, this isn't about human rights, this isn't about spreading democracy. It's about a permanent occupation of a country, and let's not forget, a lot of people get very, very rich off of the war. This is the military-industrial complex. That's not my opinion, that's a fact. All you have to do is look at the numbers and it's clear. I'm not saying that's the primary motive for why we do what we do, but oftentimes, historically, we've found that whenever one country views itself as above other nations and protecting world peace and being the leader, there's always ulterior motives where they might rationalize, oh, we're the good guys, but behind the scenes there's a lot of fucked up shit going on. And that's not really the prime motivation. So this is absolutely unacceptable. And sorry, guys, but these wars are now Obama's Vietnams. Did you know the war in Afghanistan was less popular, according to a recent poll from about a year ago? It's less popular than the war in Vietnam was at its most unpopular point. Afghanistan is less popular than Vietnam, and Obama's like, yeah, I guess we're still going to stay there. Why? Why would you do that? We don't want to be there. We don't have any further interest in the region. There's less than 100 Al-Qaeda guys there. Why would you continue to stay there? And a lot of this also has to do with his generals and the military brass talking his ear off, just like they did with all the other presidents during Vietnam. LBJ, we learned that he wanted to get out of it, but all of his generals would tell him, you can't get out of it. You just can't get out of it, because if we leave, this bad thing happens, that bad thing happens, that bad thing happens. We can't let that happen. But he stayed there, and then what ended up happening? That's the worst part of his legacy. He would have a much better legacy if he didn't stay in Vietnam, because he was doing the war on poverty and he was doing some decent stuff domestically. But that tarnished his legacy because he listened to the military guys, who shockingly see a military solution to fucking everything. So it's just, Obama should fucking know better, man. You should know better. You were elected for a reason. This is supposed to be a democracy. If we're not talking about a constitutional issue, which is off the table, then you are supposed to listen to the will of the people. And you're simply not doing that. Yes, Bush gets the blame for starting the wars, but 100% Obama gets the blame for continuing the wars. All right, now, if you can't tell, I was pretty upset about that. Now let's go on here. It appears that we have a new Edward Snowden, who leaked information on the drone campaign to The Intercept. So the International Business Times reports on this piece from The Intercept, quote, nearly 90% of the people killed by U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan over a five-month period were not the intended targets. The Pentagon internally admitted in 2013 that U.S. drone strikes are often carried out based on faulty intelligence. Even when drone strikes do kill the intended target, the Pentagon found the killing may compromise more valuable intelligence gathering operations. All right, so guys, let's fully understand what's happening here. Now, it wasn't that long ago that investigative reporters released some information, released some data that said over 90% of the drone strikes are not getting top Al-Qaeda officials. And you had people in the mainstream media laugh the report off or just not discuss the report in any way, shape, or form. I know when I would discuss this with people online on Twitter, for example, which isn't, I mean, obviously you're not going to get high-minded debate most of the time on Twitter, but you would reference, you know, that, hey, we're not really getting the right people with these drone strikes, and people would kind of, you know, brush it off or mock it or act like, pussy lib. And now, to be perfectly clear, what they're saying here is, yeah, the investigative reporters were pretty much 100% correct. This is internal documents, internal memos in the government where they're saying to each other 90% of the time we're not getting the right people. So this isn't, you know, from Code Pink or some uber liberal source that you can't trust because you think they'll bias it in that direction. These were internal memos. They're so fucking internal that they weren't even supposed to be released, but we had somebody who leaked this in good conscience because they know that the government should not be able to hide from us what they're doing with our tax dollars when they're killing innocent people. So credit to this new Edward Snowden. We don't know his name yet, by the way, his or her name. They say, the Obama administration has consistently declined to discuss drone operations publicly other than to tell the public that each strike is the targeted killing of a person who constituted an imminent threat to U.S. national security. Documents published by The Intercept contradict those assurances. They continue, one 2013 document circulated by the Pentagon's Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Unit details how the U.S. government continuously updates a profile on potential targets. They're each assigned a number, colloquially known as the terror suspect's baseball card, at which point it took President Obama an average of 58 days to approve a strike on that person. Quote, anyone caught in the vicinity is guilty by association, the source told The Intercept. If, quote, a drone strike kills more than one person, there is a guarantee that those persons deserve their fate. So it's a phenomenal gamble. Strikes are carried out faster, they say, in Afghanistan and Iraq, which are U.S. war zones compared to Yemen and Somalia. And as previous reports revealed, the U.S. assumes all military-age males in a strike zone are potential enemy combatants. There you have it, guys. This is no longer just some far-left, you know, blame America first stuff, as a lot of people wrongly thought it was at the beginning. This is the government admitting internally, talking about it. Yeah, all military-age males, they're suspects. And whoop, 90% of the time we get the wrong people. You can't have it. Now, I've described before on this show, I'm not somebody who's against drones in principle. But if you do drone strikes, you have to do them intelligently, and you have to have a process set up in order to do it. You can't just fucking attack and ask questions later. I mean, it should be, you should have to go through, anytime you do a drone war, you should have to get war declared through Congress, because a drone war is war. Then also, you should have to get approval from the UN, you should have to get approval from NATO, you should have some sort of a system set up where it's not just one person saying, yeah, do that one. You should have some sort of, you know, committee that involves whatever, generals and people that are on the right subcommittees in Congress, and have everybody get together. Okay, are these targets okay? If the targets are okay, make sure you run them. There should be some judicial process involved in this as well. And I know people say, well, come on, that's inefficient. It's not going to work. You can't do things fast enough. But guys, we know that the system we have now, which is the opposite of that, is the real failure. The real failure, There's evidence of it right here. 90% of the time you get the wrong people, then obviously the way you're doing it is fucked up. And either you don't do drone strikes at all, or when you do them, you go through the proper process. You make sure that you have enough layers of oversight that when you're actually getting a target, well, for fuck's sake, you better know it's al-Baghdadi and you better have no civilian casualties or the fewest amount humanly possible. And that's not what we're doing. That's not our concern. We don't care about international law. We don't care about U.S. law. We don't care about the Constitution. We've gotten to the point where we're numb to how we wage these wars and how little we value human life in certain regions, specifically the Middle East and North Africa. You have to be against civilian deaths across the board. Everybody's rightly outraged when a U.S. civilian gets killed under any circumstances. Yemeni civilians don't count any fucking less. And make no mistake about it, if you're getting 90% the wrong people, this is absolutely fueling people to go join jihadists. This is why we've had studies that have shown that more people have become terrorists after we declared the war on terrorism. So if your goal was to limit or eliminate terrorists, you had the exact opposite effect. It was a total and utter failure, just like the drug war. Hey, we need to minimize or eliminate drug use. That's what they thought when they started the war on terror. What happened? Now there's more drug use and a cadre of other social ills that come along with it. Same thing with the war on terror. Ah, terrorism, bad. We got to fight it. Whoops, we killed 90% civilians. Whoops, we made you a lot more people join terrorist groups now because they're pissed off about their family members and their friends being dead. We got to think this through, guys. We got to be smart about this, and we're not being smart about this. And unfortunately, with a guy like Obama and many of the Democrats today, you get soft imperialism from them. You get out-and-out imperialism from the likes of the Republicans and the neocons like Dick Cheney and George Bush and a lot of the people running on the Republican side now. But those are your choices. All-out imperialism, where you ground invade everywhere and stay there and just do all-out war, or soft imperialism, where, oh, aren't we so kind? We just do drone strikes and airstrikes and have military advisors on the ground where we kill 90% civilians. But what? We're not all out invading. Like us more. No, I don't want to have either of those options. I want there to be a third option, which is let's get the fuck out of everywhere where we shouldn't be, and let's only use military force to protect against imminent attacks against the nation, which is not what we're doing here. All right. I want to squeeze in two more, but I don't have time for that. Let me do one more, and then we'll take a break. Similar to the Marco Rubio story, let's go back to Fox and Friends here, where they're going to bitch about the Democrats and their free stuff. Fox and Friends is going to yuck it up over the Democratic debate and remind the world how out of touch they are.
I think she did what she had to do. I think, you know, Bernie Sanders, I can't watch Bernie Sanders without thinking of George Steinbrenner in Seinfeld, you know, with just the voice.
Exactly.
You know, Calzone, bring me the Calzone. I mean, I can't. That's all
Fake
I think
laughs.
Of is Bernie Sanders, the Calzone. Cassandra. I mean, I just can't get that out of my mind.
Well, the thing is, he was yelling the entire time. I was saying that we understand that he doesn't need a bullhorn, that we have a
microphone. From Calzone, though, to free stuff.
Yeah. Well,
you were listening to him. Yeah. Everything's going to be a gravy train. Just the trough. Open it up.
Yeah. Well, the kids like it, right? All the kids in college, like, yeah, we can keep playing foosball and hanging out after college.
Look at all these babies.
They're going to take care of us. I mean, the laundry list of things that they're going to give the country gratis is quite something.
If you're on radio right now, child education, higher minimum wage, public college, public family leave, healthcare for children, and in-state tuition for illegals.
Hillary
Clinton
she said we need a new deal.
No, how outrageous. A new deal? You mean something that the American people love and are on board with? These guys are so out of touch, it's amazing. They should start calling it elitists and friends. What are you doing? First of all, the original New Deal, wildly popular. Wildly popular. A new deal would be a fantastic idea. A lot of people said when Obama was doing the stimulus, it's not going far enough, you got to do a new deal. These guys are just mocking it. Helping the peasant folk and regular people? We're only supposed to care about the rich. Let's give more tax cuts to them. You guys are so sad, and they're so incredibly out of touch. I'm not sure these guys have ever read a poll in there in all their lives. They're the entire list of free stuff that they're mocking there, all of it was one version or another of healthcare, education, maternity leave or family leave, and the minimum wage. Literally every one of those. The American people overwhelmingly support Bernie Sanders' approach and the Democratic approach and not your approach, which is to mock people over it. Every other modern nation already has, you know, paid vacation time, for example, or paid maternity leave, whereas we're the only ones that don't have it. And these guys are laughing at the rest of the world who have it right and acting like, what, oh, it's obviously superior to make you work when, you know, you should get a vacation or you should get some time off to spend with your kids. Whatever happened to family values? I thought you guys cared about family values. Except when you want to force people to work when they just had a fucking baby. What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? Education, healthcare, really? That's an area where the government shouldn't be involved. Why has every other modern nation decided these are areas where it's off the table, the government should be involved, it should be funded with tax dollars? Again, you guys are mocking it. As if we don't have the facts on our shitty healthcare system, which is private, and we can't compare it to Canada, for example, or we can't compare it to the UK. Guys, 45,000 people die every year in America because they don't have access to basic healthcare. And these guys are laughing at government-run healthcare, which has better outcomes. God, they're so ridiculous. And remember, guys, to the argument of they want free stuff, no. First of all, taxes pay for it. So it's not free. We pay money to the government. And what we want is them to prioritize in a more rational way. That's what it comes down to. So whereas the Republicans are fine with paying taxes and, okay, let's have that money go to corporate welfare and let's have that money go to wars killing brown people overseas, that's what they want to spend their money on. They want to prioritize that first. Fine, but you're stupid if that's what you want to do. If you have misplaced priorities that much and you're that much of a masochist where you want your money to go to terrible things as opposed to smart things, okay, that's your problem and you got to deal with it. But there's a reason why in the polls these things are overwhelmingly popular. Because we all know that we're going to pay taxes at one rate or another, and it's just a matter of what we tell the government to do with our own money. And the Republican Party has decided corporate welfare and war. The Democratic Party wants health care and education. And people can see which one of those makes more sense. A lot of people seem to get it. The majority of people seem to get it, but the Fox News hosts do not. God damn it. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I got a bunch of stuff to get to, including Donald Trump rips Bernie Sanders in a hilariously stupid way, Rand Paul's campaign is tanking like nobody's business, and Mike Huckabee has a message for immigrants, and spoiler alert, it's not really in line with what Jesus would like. We'll be right back.
son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. Donald Trump and how he treats Bernie Sanders. It's funny, like, when these guys make these kinds of ads, I always think, do they not have anybody in the room that's like, you know, I'm not so sure that's a good idea, man. All right, let's do it. Donald Trump released a hilarious anti-Bernie Sanders ad here on Instagram. Let's take a look.
The world is a dangerous place. We need a tough, strong leader. And it's not this guy.
He says he can't even defend his microphone. How will he defend the country? So protesters are akin to ISIS. Now, how is it that nobody in the room, nobody who's one of your top advisors or on your staff, nobody was like, you know, Donald, let's not, I mean, that's a bad road to go down, it looks like. How can you really compare protesters to ISIS? And do you really want to say that Black Lives Matter protesters are like ISIS? Because you already don't necessarily have the best record when it comes to African Americans, and then you're going to do this, and the entire Black Lives Matter movement is going to kick a campaign against you into hyperdrive. They already didn't like you, but look at what you're doing here. Really? And the implication, so what he's getting at there is also profoundly dumb, because you're implying that, you're insinuating that Bernie Sanders, because he backed down when a protester was filibustering and grabbing the microphone, that means that he's going to be weak on foreign policy when it comes to ISIS. I'm pretty sure that if Bernie Sanders ever learned of a threat of imminent attack against the United States of America from any terrorist group, he would take action. And let's think about this. What do the Republicans do? Everything looks like a nail to them, so they hammer the shit out of it. So you're the ones that, ironically, have created more terrorists, as we were just describing in the last segment. When we started the war on terror, there were fewer terrorists in the world. Now, because we've executed the war so badly, there are more terrorists. Same with the drug war. Drug war was such an epic failure that now more people are doing drugs. It's the same dynamic at work here. So, Donald, come on, man. I mean, I would tell you to stick to the substance, but that's ridiculous in and of itself, because clearly you're incapable of doing such things. Okay. Now we go to the funniest story of the day, Rand Paul, our buddy Rand Paul. God, what a failure he's been, huh, with his campaign? Rand Paul decided to Ustream a full day on the campaign trail, and this is a desperate attempt to save his tanking campaign and his terrible chances now to be the nominee on the Republican side. So let's just say it didn't go well. He had high hopes for this thing, and it did not go well. Rachel Maddow did a segment on it. Let's watch.
At the Madison Show tweets, at Rand Paul's hair looks like ramen noodles. I guess that's an insult, and I'll just accept it. Donald Trump, who put Donald Trump in this thing? At Real Donald Trump tweets, watching Rand Paul for the entire day, I would say that'd be one of the lowest ranked shows in history. Well, we'll just see, won't we, Donald?
Rand Paul reading mean tweets during the miserable live stream of his presidential campaign day yesterday. And partly it was miserable because he seems miserable. Partly it was miserable because as his day was streamed on a website called Ustream, it emerged that after a full day of that behind-the-scenes access to Senator Paul on Ustream, he still has only 148 total followers on Ustream.
Oh.
But mostly it was miserable because this kind of just is what misery looks like, I'm guessing, from a candidate. And fair warning, there is a little swear here.
They also tell me, because I'm just doing what I'm told, riding around Iowa, looking at cornfields and answering silly questions, that I'm now supposed to answer the top Googled questions about me. The first question is, how tall is Rand Paul? And it's 5'8", but I do look a lot taller on TV. The next question is, how old is Rand Paul? The answer is, or the real answer, I guess, is 52, but I sometimes feel about 10 to 20 to maybe 30 to 40 to 50 years older after this. The third question, most popular question from Google is Rand Paul still running for president? And I don't know, wouldn't be doing this dumbass live streaming if I weren't. But yes, I still am running for president. Get over it. Where is Rand Paul in the poll? This is not live. We can't edit this, right? All right.
Well, this is live. We all heard you just say you feel like you're 102 when you're doing this with your life these days. This is your life, Senator. We can all see you. Honestly, though, we're starting to feel bad about it at a human level.
That's the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. Oh, that's so sad. Oh, he was so miserable. Oh my God! It's like he knows that it's gonna be over soon, man. You're polling at like 1%. You had a great opportunity at the beginning. You were riding some momentum. You were the anti-drone war libertarian-ish candidate. There was some genuine grassroots support for that on the right. You had a good opportunity if you ran a good campaign and you stayed on your message and you continued to be yourself and you didn't listen to all the advisors and try to out right wing all the other idiots on stage. But what happened? Oh, he made every wrong decision from when he decided to run for president. Now he's at like 1%. He's an utter disaster. He can't get any traction. And he knows. You can almost smell the nihilism on him as you're watching this. It's like, oh, man. Yeah, you think nothing matters right now, don't you? It's a dreary day in Iowa. He's reading tweets. I would want to talk to his staffers there to be like, did you know which tweets you were feeding him? Every single tweet that he read, and there were more. I didn't show you all of them here. They were just all ripping on him. Every single one was ripping on him. And he lashed out. He couldn't help it. He's like, of course I'm still running for president, or I wouldn't be doing this dumbass live stream. Can we edit this? Fuck, we can't edit this. God damn it. Oh, and the numbers. 148 followers on Ustream. Now, to be overly kind to him here, his total number of views was 35,000. Now, I don't know if they just set up Rand Paul's Ustream account for this and this alone, and that was all 35,000 in just his live stream day, or if that's accumulated over time and his Ustream account had been there for a while and there were other videos on it and stuff. So I don't know all the details of that. But 148 followers is incredibly pathetic, and 35,000 viewers, I mean, to put that in perspective for you guys, normal day on Secular Talk, it's about 235,000 views. Rand, I'm sorry, bro. I really do feel kind of bad, too, because on the right, I think he was the most reasonable candidate. He was, for sure. He's not a libertarian, but he's libertarian-ish. And on most economic problems, if not all economic issues, I'm against him. But socially, he was better. He is against the drug war. He, did some good bipartisan work on some foreign policy stuff. So he was the best candidate, but he ran a horrible campaign, and now it just, it's painful to watch it. I totally agree with Rachel Maddow there when she seems to genuinely say at the end, yeah, at a human level, this is just wrong. How sad was that, man? Oh, poor Rand Paul. Or Rand Paul. All right. Let's see what else I got. I got 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, 4 stories. Can we get them? Yeah, I think we'll have plenty of time to squeeze all these in here. Ooh, this is a doozy. We got Mike Huckabee, who's also somehow still running for president. Mike Huckabee wants to give those damn Syrian rebels a piece of his mind here. He's going to tell them what our policy towards them should be. And you're going to be not surprised at all to find out it's anti-biblical.
I think it's time for us to stand up to some of these Middle Eastern tyrants and tell them that we're tired of being
you know, the one country that's expected to do all the dirty work and to take all of the problems. This country is willing to take in people who are desperate. We did that. And I remember after the Vietnam War, Arkansas took in an enormous number of Vietnamese refugees. And guess what? Those folks worked their tails off. They learned English. Their kids ended up becoming the valedictorians half the time.
Right, right.
But that was because they wanted to come to America. They wanted freedom, and they decided that they wanted to be part of this great country. And they have certainly succeeded at that, owning businesses and prospering. But just to say that if somebody is not living a very fancy life, they'd like to come here because we've given them free benefits. No, we can't do that.
Jesus disagrees. Now, remember, I would not be doing this segment in this way if it wasn't the case that Mike Huckabee, every other sentence, talks about his Christianity, talks about the Bible, talks about Jesus, talks about faith, says that stuff is not debatable, says it's straight from God, and is flat out a theocrat. This guy believes in theocracy through and through to the point where he said the last time he ran that there are some people in this race that do not want to place the Constitution with God's law. Not kidding, he said that. So I wouldn't be bringing this up if it wasn't already his standard, already his criteria, already what he says he believes in. So what does the Bible say about immigrants? Now, understand that the term sojourner is basically the same thing as immigrants. That's a different way to refer to that, and this is the terminology they would use. You know, this is the terminology that was used to mean that going back. So, now that we know that, what does the Bible say? Leviticus 19, lines 33 to 34. Quote, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. Well, that seems to be pretty loving and open to all people. Well, how about the next thing? Exodus 22. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him. That's pretty straightforward. Deuteronomy 27:19. Cursed be anyone who perverts the justice due to the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. So, to be crystal clear, we're talking about oppressed people here, people who lost their home, who are travelers in your land, and you have to be kind to them, you have to be nice to them, because that's a reflection on who you are. And you're a bad person if you don't treat them right. This isn't me speaking, this is your God, Mike Huckabee. All right, more. Hebrews 13. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. Jeremiah 19:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Would you look at that? The Bible literally arguing in favor of welfare. So I take it that now Mike Huckabee knows this. He's going to come out, apologize, and change his position because, naturally, he's just a human. This is God speaking. He believes this is God speaking. So he's got to take God's word for it because that's just how it is. And this is what Mike Huckabee has told us in other contexts, like when it comes to gay people. Are you going to do that, Mike? I know you're not going to do that. Now, understand, guys. Am I the kind of person, and they say at different times in this conversation, vetting is important, blah, blah, blah. I agree with that. I would, you know, vet any immigrant coming from anywhere into the United States to make sure that if we're giving people refugee status, that everything's all good. And understand, we didn't do this in the past, and there was this case about, I forget which state it was in, but people came in, turns out they had Al-Qaeda connections, and we ended up putting them on trial, they went to jail, and okay. So we get it. Okay, some people come in, they're not necessarily good people, so you have to have some sort of a system set up to vet people to be smart about it. I'm on that page 100%. I'd let in a lot of immigrants, but I would vet everybody. But see, the thing is, a guy like Mike Huckabee, that's not his position. And even if that was his position, that's still not liberal enough according to the Bible, which he says he believes. So understand, there are two sides to almost everything in the Bible. I mean, you want to back up a genocide. You want to back up mass killing. There's backing up for that in the Bible. But then there's also backup for don't kill anybody. Thou shalt not kill, among many other things. You know, there's an argument to take a conservative position or a liberal position on a variety of issues. There are some issues where there aren't two sides in the Bible. One of them is how you treat the poor. Another one is what you do with sojourners or immigrants on your land. On both those issues, Mike Huckabee is a swing and a miss according to his own God. So by his own logic, he'll be going to his own hell unless he changes his mind and flips his position. Mike, I'm waiting. All right, now, switch it back up here, do some very serious shit. NASA and the nonprofit organization Climate Central are out with a new study on the effects of global warming, and they discovered something devastating. They report, quote, no matter what we do to fight climate change, it is already too late for more than 400 U.S. cities, including Miami and New Orleans, which will be overcome by rising sea levels. Under a worst-case scenario, New York could be unlivable by the year 2085. Most of the population in those cities live within 5 feet of the current high tide line. So they go on to explain how some of this could happen as early as next century, but it could also potentially take many centuries. But they do know that at some point, no matter what we do, we could cut off all carbon emissions right now. We're still going to lose some very important cities. They say, quote, the reason that current efforts to combat climate change won't save many of these cities is because of what mankind has done in the past, as carbon pollution that humans have already emitted will continue to affect planetary surface temperature for centuries to come. Yeah, so this is devastating news. And, I mean, again, one of the things I always talk about when we bring up climate change is that I actually disagreed big time with liberals when they would discuss climate change and their only focus would be something like sea level rise. Because I feel like that's one of the issues where it doesn't land well with people. Like, you talk about sea level rise and it's always theoretical. It's always like, well, there's a lot of time between now and then and we could just move people or we could build a giant seawall. So there's ways where people could, you know, just put that under the rug and say, eh, whatever, you know, that's not, if that's the worst we have to worry about, then whatever, it is what it is. Well, here we have an example of basically, the worst-case scenario for sea level rise is already guaranteed, but then beyond that, again, to go back to my main point on this, this is the least of your worries. This really is the least of your worries with climate change. I mean, what happens, for example, when fresh water runs out in certain areas where they get their fresh water from snow caps on mountaintops, as many places in the Midwest do? What happens when there's no more snow caps on mountaintops? Well, Kyle, then you got to go underground, and there's some underground reservoirs that we could tap into. Except, because of the Halliburton loophole, as it's called, fracking companies dump their wastewater in the underground reservoirs, and that's contaminated now. So you're living in the Midwest in the U.S. You live in an area where you get all your fresh water from snow caps on mountaintops. There are no more snow caps on mountaintops, and you can't get water from underground. What do you do? What happens when there's nonstop drought in some areas? What happens when the climate permanently changes in some places that are not deserts now but are going to become deserts? What happens when there's an increase in natural disasters and they happen on such a regular basis that over a certain amount of time we have to spend trillions of dollars to do cleanup and rebuilding and stuff like that? What happens when there are wars in some places over water rights? Specifically, more third world countries for that one. What happens when food prices shoot up tremendously because the food chain is messed up as a result of certain species being affected by climate change and basically going extinct much faster? What happens there? All of these questions, very few answers we have. We're basically heading into the abyss here. Now, again, we're humans, so what are we doing? We fuck up everything, and then at the last minute we try, okay, now we got to fix this, because fuck, this is a real problem. We're facing it now. But this is one of those things where that approach might not work. This might be an area where you need the foresight. You need to act well in advance. You need to set up the proper infrastructure. You need to move to green technology. But in our infinite stupidity, We don't do dick. And the little we do is functioning within a system that has, for example, the fossil fuel companies owning the government, just as bad in the U.S. as it is elsewhere. They pay so much money to the politicians that the politicians look the other way as the fossil fuel companies destroy our planet. This isn't hippie liberal, you know, tree hugger shit. This is hardcore science shit. We got to wake up. We got to do something to try to stop it, because the rate we're going here, like I said, the most scary part is this is the least of your worries. The fact that we'll have to move some coastal cities elsewhere and that the sea level will rise, the least of your worries. It's going to get a lot worse than that. All right, let me do two more here, and then we'll call it a day. Huffington Post has a mind-blowing article out about a life ruined by the Chicago Police Department. They say, quote, more than 25 years after police tortured him into confessing a murder he didn't commit, Sean Wuerl walked out of an Illinois prison Wednesday afternoon. An appeals court in August threw out Wuerl's conviction and ordered a new trial, but he never went back to court. Prosecutors dropped the case, and on Tuesday, a judge dismissed all charges. Wuerl, who's 45 years old, is the first person granted a new trial on a referral from the Illinois Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission, formed in 2009 to address the wrongful convictions of people tortured into confessions under the watch of disgraced former police commander John Burge. Burge and his so-called midnight crew of detectives tortured an estimated 192 people, mostly black men, during the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s. Damn. This was systemic. They continue. In April 1990, Wuerl was 20. He worked as a computer operator, had a girlfriend, and a close relationship to his mother. He had no criminal history. He was arrested and charged with the Southside murder of a 40-year-old cab driver named Billy Williams after police found his fingerprints in the back of the cab. Wuerl said he had jumped into Williams' cab 2 days earlier to escape gang members who were trying to stick him up for his hat and his jacket. He told detectives that he had nothing to do with the murder, court records show. After hours of interrogation, with Wuerl still handcuffed to a wall, Chicago detective James Panetta entered the room. He stepped on Wuerl's foot, said, and I quote, "Wake up, nigger," and slapped Wuerl in the face, according to court records. The detective told Wuerl his previous statement won't do. Wuerl continued to say he was innocent. Panetta, according to the court records, gashed Wuerl's leg with a set of keys. Wuerl's girlfriend testified she had been taken in for questioning by police at the same time and could hear Wuerl hollering from a room nearby. Wuerl eventually signed a statement confessing to the murder under torture. Then when it went to court, he tried to take it back, and they basically said, okay, then we're going to let it go to trial, and they were just going to find him guilty. So he's like, all right, fine, I'll take the guilty plea if I don't get the death penalty. They were going to give him the death penalty the other way. This was back when they still had the death penalty. The story gets worse. The guy who was responsible for running the department that tortured well over 100 people. Did you know? So this guy went to jail for 3.5 years on something unrelated. I think it was perjury. Now he lives in Florida, and he collects $4,000 a month from his job from when he was a police officer. You're telling me there isn't two justice systems in America, or maybe even more, three or four justice systems, depending on how much power you have? What? I'm a cop. I'm a good guy by definition. If I do something wrong, well, give me a little slap on the wrist, let me out early for good behavior, even though I tortured 192 people, and give me my money. You know, I'm going to take away my money. Just give me my money. Let me live in Florida and be on a beach all day long when I spend my career torturing people into false confessions. That person should be spending a life sentence. They should be serving a life sentence. Oh, come on, man. What are we doing here? And then also they go on to explain that this guy who had 25 years of his life robbed by the state and a corrupt officer, they're like, well, you're not guaranteed to get money for what you went through here. And if you do, you got to go through a process, you got to take it through the court system or whatever, and the max you'll get is capped at like $200,000. This fucking guy deserves at least $10 million. He shouldn't have to work a day in the rest of his life for what he went through. Tortured into a false confession, spent 25 years in jail, he never did it, and the guy who fucking did it to him is on a beach in Florida collecting money from the state. Where's the justice? There is no justice. All right. And finally, let's wrap it up here with Pat Robertson. So Pat Robertson recently stepped out. Okay, that's not the way to phrase it. Let's try that again. Pat Robertson recently got some surgery, so he wasn't on his show. And he came back the other night, and some intelligent or somewhat intelligent viewers thought, how about I ask him why he needs surgery when he's a man of God? And he often does segments where he says, I am now faith healing people out there with this ailment and that ailment. If you can do that, if you have those magical powers, then why the fuck do you need to go to doctors who use modern medicine based off of science, which is the opposite of what you preach? Here's his answer.
This is Robin. This is Pat. I heard you answer a question Tuesday regarding faith and healing. My quandary with your view is, why have you undergone surgeries that your faith would be enough? This is a sincere question, not meant to offend in any way. I hope you'll address it.
Well, I appreciate it. Listen, I want you to know something. I don't think that religion, faith, and medicine are necessarily enemies. I think that godly people are used by God to come forth with healing techniques that alleviate sickness and suffering and so forth. I've been simply amazed at the wonders that the medical profession can perform. So you say, how come you didn't pray that something would get taken away? Well, the Lord might say, you prayed and go to see that doctor and he'll take the mole off your chin or something.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah, exactly.
But I don't know what else to say. You can, you know, if you have enough faith, maybe I don't have enough, but I have faith for other people. But for myself, I think I did the right thing.
I like how towards the end there, he gets caught up in his own bullshit and he can't really answer anymore. I don't know if he realizes how absurd it is or he never thought about it before and he just got caught up in his own nonsense or whatever it was. But by the end, he was like, other people have faith, not, I don't know if I have enough faith, but I think other people do have enough faith. I made the right decision? So clearly, not convincing anybody, even himself. But at the beginning, did you catch what he said at the beginning? Because this is really important here. So he starts off by saying, well, I mean, modern medicine and faith, they're not necessarily against each other here. And I think that God has scientists and doctors and basically picks them and they do God's work through, you know, what their job is and how they fix people. It's amazing what they can do. So notice how the game is rigged with that answer. So if God just faith heals somebody, the person doesn't go to a doctor, they pray, and boom, you know, their cancer is gone, which doesn't happen, let's be clear. Well, then that's obviously give God the credit. God just faith heals you. And the evidence, you didn't go to a doctor. You just, but boom, you prayed and it's fixed. But then if you also say, I have cancer, let me go get treatment, and the doctors give you treatment and your cancer goes into remission, in Pat's mind also in that circumstance, oh, it was God. Because God was working through the doctors. God picked the doctors, and the doctors went and did the work. But God was the one who was the source of the fixing, not the doctors. It was God who directed the doctors to do the fixing. So the game is rigged. It's a non-falsifiable claim. If it's modern medicine and science and enlightenment principles that lead to curing somebody, you say, God cured me. And if the medicine is not there and somebody just gets faith healed, you go, well, God fixed me. Do you realize how ridiculous this is? No, that's people need to know. And unfortunately, at other times, Pat doesn't allude to this and he doesn't make it clear. But people need to know that one way is bullshit, and if you try one way, it's going to have bad results. And the other way is backed by science and reason and the Enlightenment and problem solving. That's modern medicine. But unfortunately, as Pat Robertson has done time and time again on his show, we've seen the clips, we've shown the clips. He'll do the thing where he holds hands with his co-host and he closes his eyes and he goes, "There's somebody right now feeling a toothache, and I want you to know that you've been trying to get rid of it for a few days and now it's healed." And he's done stuff like this all the time. And Pat, when you do that, and the person listening to you is not that bright, that might give them all they need to hear to say, you know what, I don't like trust doctors, I don't like going to doctors anyway, and now that, oh, Pat, talk about a tooth, I have a toothache, well, now I might just sit at home and maybe it'll be gone that way. You're actively damaging people when you say faith healing is possible, when you allude to the fact that you engage in it from time to time. Pat said before he's raised dead people as well. That's nonsense, and it has a negative effect in the real world. What you should say is very clearly, faith is one thing, science is another, medicine is another. Don't conflate the two. If you're ever sick for any reason whatsoever, don't test your faith. Go to the doctors, because we know that what they do has a better chance of working, because the Lord works in mysterious ways, and perhaps he won't fix you. You have to say something like that. If you do anything else, it's dangerous. All right, guys, out of time. Love you. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. An hour show tomorrow. I got something I got to take care of afterwards, so it's just an hour show, but it'll be a great show. All right, love you guys. See you tomorrow. Peace.